Hi there. Welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Matt Anderson of the Sci-Fi Christian, and we're going to be talking about John Scalzi's Red Shirts, which was the 2013 winner of the Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Matt, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, Seth, thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. This completes the both sides of the Sci-Fi Christian now, since I had been on to talk about Lord of Light.
That's right.
And I'm sorry I didn't get you on first. But
no, it's okay. But no, I love that conversation. That it's funny, that book was one that he recommended to me early on in our podcasting together. And I did read it a long time ago, but we ended up never doing an episode about it. So you beat me to it, even though I had a 6-year head start.
Right. Yeah. And you guys just passed your 600th episode, and here I'm working on number 10. So
yeah. Well, yeah, it's been a fun ride, and yeah, I'm just shooting to get to 1,000, and then who knows what happens after that.
Well, so why don't you talk about where people might know you from?
Sure. Well, our podcast that we've been talking about is called The Sci-Fi Christian, and you can find it at thescifichristian.com. We've been doing this since 2011. We started out actually in 2010. We were doing a podcast for our church. We were at a small church together, Ben and myself, and we did a podcast called The Life Report, which was a supplement to the sermon. So if the sermon series was on, let's say, discipleship, we would talk about discipleship, but from a different angle than what the sermon did. And it would, like I said, sort of be a supplement to the conversation that was on Sunday. So did that for a while, but we started to notice that our love of sci-fi and just different TV and movie things, pop culture references, would slip into this church-based podcast. So just a few months after we started that podcast, I think it was only 3 or 4 months after we did The Life Report, we started The Sci-Fi Christian as well. So that was in January 2011. And then we eventually just stopped doing The Life Report altogether. And now here we are just doing The Sci-Fi Christian, and we're about to hit, I think it will be, we started in 2011, so it'll be 7 years in January that we've been doing this.
Nice.
Yeah. So yeah, basically we talk about theology, pop culture, lots of movie reviews, philosophy, all sorts of things. And then we also cover the weekly news of the week when it comes to movie, TV, book news, anything like that. So we usually put out 2 or 3 episodes every week.
Yep. I set my calendar by it. So, well, how about a little bit of your history? You know, have you always kind of been a nerdy type? And I guess what I'm really wanted to know is, a lot of the folks that I've had on have been really big book people from the beginning, and others were more kind of introduced to it through movies or television. So what does your history look like for science fiction nerdery?
Sure. Yeah. Always been into the sci-fi pop culture world ever since I was little. My mom was kind of has similar interests as I do. That's how I got into it. So at a young age, I was watching things ranging from Star Trek to Star Wars, but then TV, we'd have Sliders, which was a huge favorite of mine. Quantum Leap, love that. Try to think of some other early shows. And then comic books were big to me when I was in, around 10 and up, in my early middle school days and elementary school days. So all that stuff, always been interested. But when it comes to actually reading literature, I enjoy reading, but I don't think I really got heavy into reading tons of books until we started The Sci-Fi Christian. So Ben is a big reader. There used to be lots of jokes about me starting books and not finishing them, or just taking forever to read them. So I think, and this could be wrong, I have it on Goodreads right now, but I think it was 2012 or 2011 that I had finished 4 books in a year. And right now, I mean, last year was kind of crazy. Last year I had a big reading goal. I read over 100... I want to say it was like 140 maybe last year. But this year won't be. This year's going to be a more average year for me of where I'm currently at when it comes to reading. So I think I'll be around 30 to 40 books at the end of this year. So quite a change from where I was before. I feel like I've been exposed to tons of new things just since starting the podcast. So when we talk about which Hugo winners have I read, almost all of the ones I'm about to name will have happened within the last 6 or 7 years for me.
Oh, nice. You know, it's not all that different from my story. It probably stretches back 15 years for me, just because kind of once I was out of college, I mean, even when I was in college, I started really getting into reading more, because I have a technical degree. And so I got really tired of just nuts and bolts and figures and math and that kind of stuff. So I almost always would bring a book with me to class, and that's where I started really getting into reading. But it wasn't so much getting into science fiction until I started having some friends who were also into it, who were guiding me, like Colin, guiding me into reading more science fiction and fantasy. So, so yeah, my science fiction resurgence is fairly recent as well. So, but on that topic, did you tally up how many Hugo Award winners you've actually read?
I did. I have hit 9 books from this list. So where is that rate against you? How many are you at again?
I'm at 19 now.
Okay.
So
2 are in the queue for probably next year. The Canticle for Leibowitz, I've got that ready to go. And T.H. White's Sword in the Stone, I'm going to read actually the whole, Once in Future King? Is that his?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think I'll read through that whole thing. So those are on the queue.
I might have to have you back for that, unless you're going to do an episode on the Sci-Fi Christian on that, because that's one of the early winners of the retro Hugo.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be fun. Yeah, and Ben and I have talked about doing that possibly next year, but maybe we could do a huge crossover episode.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Yeah, the only book of those 9 that I read prior to the podcast, or prior to me podcasting, was Fahrenheit 451. I read that in high school, but then I just read it again, I want to say last year, the year before. And then do you want me to just quickly read the other ones off?
Or
do you,
sure.
Yeah, just only 9 or only 8 more. Man of the High Castle, read that for the first time recently. Dune, Lord of Light, Ender's Game, Hyperion, American Gods, Graveyard Book, and then Red Shirts.
You know, I think I could have named most of your list just from hearing you guys talk on the Sci-Fi Christian.
Yeah, exactly. Typically, because I read
especially
less...
Especially after you just had the episode on the Sci-Fi Christian canon.
Oh, yeah.
Because you went through everything that you talked about on the show.
Exactly. Yeah. Typically, this is not universal, of course, but if I finish a classic book that Ben has read, well, he probably has read it, then we'll usually do an episode on it. Right. But yeah. Yeah, I'm really into it right now. I mean, my world is totally different. I used to do heavy movie and TV viewing and little on the books, and now I'd say it's probably more slanted towards book reading. So maybe not all the way, 60-40 or 70-30, but nice. Yeah, that's my world these days is definitely more book driven.
So why this book, man? Why Red Shirts?
So I mentioned earlier that I watched Star Trek growing up. To be honest, not as much original series. My time growing up was Next Generation was just debuting. So big into Next Generation, watched a lot of Deep Space Nine, a little bit of Voyager, and barely an Enterprise. So original series I've seen tons here and there, but it's not a show I've ever watched straight through. Although in preparation for this episode, I've been watching more episodes that I never saw of the original series just to kind of get in that world. But when I heard the idea, I've always thought this idea of the red shirts in Star Trek as being these characters that were just basically created to die. I thought it's funny when it's referenced in pop culture. And so when I found out there was a book that was going to just kind of tackle the subject on what's going on with the red shirts, I like that idea. So that's what first made me pick it up. And I was really pleasantly surprised with where the story went, totally different direction than I expected. So when you had sent me the list of potential books, this one really popped out to me. Plus, I just read it for the first time in January 2016, and then read it a second time here in September 2017.
Okay, so how about, let's see. I guess at this point we can kind of get into our non-spoiler discussion. It's going to be pretty hard to discuss anything about this book without some amount of spoilers. But I think people know that this one falls into the category of metafiction. And we'll talk, I'm sure, quite a bit about that. But can you give a quick, as non-spoiler as possible, synopsis / elevator pitch for the book?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been thinking about this, and how could you talk about it without talking about the metafiction aspect? So here it is. There's a new crew member on a ship that would be reminiscent of something like the Starship Enterprise, although it's not that. It's just a totally different world, but really similar to the Star Trek world. So there's a new crew member, actually a few different new crew members. As they're learning more about this ship, they start to learn that the ship's captain and his immediate first officers, they go on a lot of missions, and they are traditionally always safe on those missions, but anybody they bring with them, sort of the ensigns or the lieutenants, it seems like there's always some sort of crazy death on these different missions. So as the crew members are, again, new to this, being exposed to this new information, they're starting to wonder, is there some sort of conspiracy happening? What's happening with these away missions that's causing this to be the percentage of death to be so high on this? And so that's where the story starts to unfold. There's a little bit of an investigation. And then, as we'll talk about later in the show, we find out what exactly is happening.
Nice. Yeah, I think that does it nicely without getting too much into spoilers. Just kind of a little background from me. I wanted to talk about the influence that Star Trek has had on both of us, and you kind of went into that as well. I grew up, you know, in grade school and junior high. That was before The Next Generation came out. So all there was for me was the original series in syndication. And I remember watching Star Trek when I was really young and getting nervous about the dangerous situations that the bridge officers were in. And my sisters told me that, well, don't worry about those guys. They're going to be fine. And they actually told me it was because of the symbol that they had on their uniform, which the red shirts had too. But it was good enough for me to let me know that, no, they were going to be okay. But so I was kind of familiar with the bridge crew is going to be just fine, but the red shirts are screwed kind of thing from a pretty early age.
Yeah, I'm just having a flashback. I also remember watching a lot of the Star Trek animated series. And again, before the days of Next Generation, just watching it on reruns, maybe a Saturday morning type thing. So yeah, I was into the original crew, even though I've probably seen, well, I know I've seen much less of that series than Next Generation.
Right. Well, and for a long time, all we had was the original series films, and that's kind of what I grew up with that was coming out in real time. Like, I think I went to see The Wrath of Khan in the theater, actually.
Oh, that's awesome.
I would have been only like 9 years old, but my sisters were huge fans. So, but anyhow, Star Trek is definitely relevant to this discussion, and we can maybe talk a little bit about how that fits in, maybe when we get into spoilers more. So, so kind of overall thoughts, Matt, what do you think of the book?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed it. There's a comedy element to it, but like I said earlier, there's also sort of a conspiracy mystery happening. As the story was unfolding, the first time I read it, I did not know what was going on. And when you do find out, I feel like it's a good payoff. There's some problems I have with it that we can talk about later, but it was much better than I had thought it would be, to be honest. I do think, I'm not sure when we want to talk about the full title of the book, but I think they changed the title officially to just Red Shirts. But when it originally came out, it was called Red Shirts, a novel with three codas.
Right.
And so I'm interested to talk with you about those three short stories that happen after the main story.
Right. And that I feel like doesn't... it isn't too spoilery to talk about some of that. Just the fact that it's a really, really quick read. It's basically the main part of the novel. It's the kind of thing you could read in a sitting, you know, in an afternoon. It's like a long novella almost. Mm-hmm. And then you get into the codas. And what I found was like, it's really enjoyable. Love the whole concept of the kind of meta narrative that's going on. And I was just, as I was reading it the first time, I thought, okay, this is a lot of fun. It reminds me of Galaxy Quest. And yet, then it gets to the codas, and the codas have some very profound ideas in them. And so it was like the depth of the whole was much more than I thought it was going to be based on what the first part was.
Yeah, totally, totally agree. Yeah, there's philosophical stuff happening, even theological to a certain extent when it comes to free will and predestination. Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Galaxy Quest, because as I think through, you know, people that may be interested in this type of book, definitely Star Trek, but also Galaxy Quest because of the comedic elements.
Yeah. I will say, though, just as kind of by way of warning people, this is like Galaxy Quest, but not as wholesome.
Sure.
Galaxy Quest is, you know, PG, I think. And they have that one, I don't know how recently you've seen Galaxy Quest, but there's one scene where Sigourney Weaver's character obviously drops an F-bomb and they just used ADR to change it.
Oh, really?
Something else.
No. I
wanted to keep the PG rating rather than PG-13.
Oh, that's interesting. No, I have seen it pretty recently, definitely within the last year. That's also a favorite of mine.
Yeah. But like I said, for me, the codas are really what make the book. And I don't want to talk too much about those until we get to the spoiler section. So,
yeah, I agree, because it is something unique about this story. And the author, I mean, that was an intentional thing for the author. He wanted to try something different because, this type of story where it's you get the main story, but then three short stories that kind of flesh things out a little bit, that I don't think that delivery style has really been done too much before. And so he wanted to do something unique in the storytelling.
Yeah. Yeah. And when we get to the actual structure of what the codas are, that's another thing also that where he takes yet another step about the way they're written. Mm-hmm. So you had kind of mentioned, you know, who might like this novel, and that's something I always like to discuss. And like we said, right. Star Trek, probably the original series more than anything, though yeah. Any of the others as well. Galaxy Quest. Did you have any other kind of ideas about people who are fans of other media?
Those were definitely the two that I noted when I was thinking about this. But I mean, it is, if you like sci-fi comedy, that's where it lands. But there's some yes. deeper things happening. So I'm not saying it's the most profound science fiction book there is, but it's going to be deeper than you'll expect as you first dive into it.
Yeah, totally. And then we'll talk more about the whole meta narrative part of it. But obviously, stuff like Stranger Than Fiction, something like Spaceballs has some meta bits of it where they, you know, break the fourth wall, which is, I suppose, different than actual meta. But I took a Masterpieces of World Literature class, and we read, I think it's a play actually called Six Characters in Search of the Author.
Oh yeah.
And that was an interesting one that kind of reminded me a little bit of Red Shirts as well. And I remember, I think you guys were talking about The Dark Tower recently, and I listened into all those because I doubt that I'll ever actually read that whole series.
Yeah.
Where you talked about Stephen King himself is in the books at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. I had wondered if I should bring it up or not because I, you know, don't want to spoil too much for The Dark Tower. So just sure. all I'll say is that in the book series, Dark Tower, in that world, people can get books, they can read books by Stephen King, even though right. the book you're reading is also by Stephen King. So yeah, right. just kind of a weird aspect of that book. But yeah, Dark Tower definitely has meta stuff happening as well. Not so much in the movie, but in the book series.
Sure. You know, Matt, I think we've been dancing around it, and we should probably just go straight to spoilers. Just
yeah, let's do it.
Give people the warning and say, you know, to continue this discussion, we're going to have to go into spoilers.
For yeah, it. Exactly.
And like I said, it's a brief book. It's not very long, even with all the codas. I read it really, really quickly, and I'm not a super fast reader. So definitely give this one a look. I know Ben had expressed that he started reading it, but didn't like Scalzi's prose. And, you know, your mileage may vary there. But I do think that the whole here is kind of more than the sum of its parts. So I definitely say it's worth reading.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and you're right. It's tough to go into a lot of detail about this book without spoiling things. So yeah, I say we just dive in and talk about it.
Yeah. So let's talk about the meta.
All right. Were you surprised that that's where they went with the story?
I kind of was. The first mention of the narrative, I thought, wait, what? And so, yeah, I was very surprised when they started going into, look, we think we're on a poorly written science fiction series. And that is bonkers. But I like the fact that Scalzi introduces some things, some little breadcrumbs that can lead you that way first, like the box, which I just think is brilliant and hilarious, where it moves at the speed of plot. You put something into it and, well, when do you need it? In 5 hours. Okay, well, in 4.5 hours, it'll spit out the answer. I just thought that was hilarious.
Yeah. So on the second read, for me, it feels obvious where all those little clues are going when you talk about narrative and other yeah. lines about it. But the first time through, it was not obvious to me. I was thinking, is it a narrative according to the captain and his first officers? Are they doing something? I definitely thought it was more conspiracy, like the Spock yeah. character was talking to people about, you're going to join us on some away missions. And it just seemed like he was really invested in getting people on the away mission. So why is that? And then you have people talking about there needs to be a sacrifice. So I was thinking more, I mean, and that ended up being incorrect. I didn't know exactly what was happening, but I definitely felt like there was a conspiracy happening. So when they first get to a mention of the TV show Star Trek, that's right. around the area where my mind was blown, like, what is happening? And yeah. I loved it. I love that twist. In fact, that's the whole reason. That one twist is the thing that really makes this, for me, the reason I wanted to discuss it with you so badly, and what made this one of my favorite reads of 2016.
Yeah, definitely. And even when you look at the structure of the book, it reads, at least the very beginning of it, it reads like a cold open of a of a television series, right? Where they start in the middle of the action and something dreadful happens and then the credits roll.
Exactly.
And I love that where I can't remember what the creatures were that were swirling around the guy and he has this moment of epiphany where he's like, wait, no, I'm going to live, you know, and I'm just going to take a run and I'm going to jump across here and I'm going to make it. And, you know, then he slipped and they ate his face and he died.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved how you would have a character like Andy, for example, where he's living his life and making choices that make sense to him. And then all of a sudden, because of the plot that is outside of their power, they're saying and doing things that are outside of their character and they can't stop themselves. It feels right at the time. And that's so interesting. This, just like we were saying before, this free will idea and what's really controlling us and is there a higher power that's making us do things? And I was really interested in those aspects as well.
Yeah, and it's one thing to introduce that idea that somehow you're being controlled. It's another thing to then go the other level and make it so that there's a way for you to confront that, you know, where they travel actually to Hollywood and talk to the people, right, and meet their twins, essentially the actors who play them. And I feel like the fact that it's even remotely plausible in a, you know, as plausible as Star Trek ever was is a tribute to Scalzi's imagination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I liked it. I want to talk a little bit more about the time travel stuff probably later. I have a little bit of a bone to pick with it, but it wasn't a deal breaker for me when it came to enjoying the book. If we're talking about all the way to the end, I've been thinking through this idea a lot now, and I don't know if it was because I was preparing for this episode and I've been doing a lot of research on the metafiction and all that type of thing, but I've been really thinking about this idea of when a book ends, does a character die? Because this book sort of has a line in there at the end about how they go on and live and everything's good. Are they confined? Are characters confined to as much of their life that we read about? Or is there something that happens beyond our view? And was there something that happened before we saw them? Or are they born the second we start reading about them? And so, you know, Andy, I don't know how old he is, let's just say he's 25 or 30. That's basically when his life started, and his life ends when we close the book. Or is he just stuck in this cycle? Yeah, I don't know what to do with that exactly. I mean, of course, I'm not saying literally with my theological thinking that I believe that these characters are alive, but just I like this idea that the characters could have a life that extends beyond the book. Or do that. Or maybe they don't. Maybe their lives are just confined to the pages that we read.
Yeah. And I do feel like the book takes a position on that where they're living their lives and everything's going along just fine. But for some reason, this fiction interacts with reality. And that's when the narrative takes over, right? So there's some way, some quantum effect or something, some technobabble that causes changes to be made based on what goes on this television show. And you do kind of also, like you said, you have the idea that, yes, these people exist because the show exists. And so if the show is canceled, yeah, will they disappear or will they just continue on without the narrative?
So where do you land on that? Outside of our personal beliefs in God, would you say, if you just had to talk about the subject outside of that, do you think characters get to keep on living in the created universe, or are their stories over when we stop reading about them or stop viewing their movie or TV show?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess I haven't given it as much thought as you have, but I'm inclined to go, no, they continue on. And that's why, you know, an author can pick up a story later on and, tell things about subsequent generations or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
Although, kind of on that topic, I know you and Ben have talked about this a lot about, for instance, with Star Wars, where they're going to have movies from now until the end of time, and they're going to explain the backstories of every little ancillary character. And like, we don't need that. We can fill that kind of stuff in ourselves. And once it's been explicitly told, it can be disappointing. I mean, just look at the prequels, right? Mm-hmm. This is not the story of how Vader became Vader to me. I had a whole story filled in for myself when all we had was the original series. And now that we have the quote canon version of it, I wish it hadn't happened. So
yeah, totally.
I love the bit about with the box, just kind of going to things that I enjoy. And at this point, we're just doing freeform discussion. So anything you want to talk about, just throw it out.
All right.
But with the box, I love the idea. There's the little kind of plausible, well, if you want to, if you need to believe this, it's some kind of alien technology that just works this way. But then, you know, we find out later that it's just a device of the narrative, right? Where put this thing in there, take it up to the bridge, talk to Commander Queen or whatever his name is, and he'll tell you that you've missed something. And tell him something like, we had a problem with the protein coat.
Yeah.
And then Queen says, oh, yeah, make sure to check your peptide bonds. I'm like, oh, sir, I don't know how we missed that.
Yeah.
It's always the protein coat with you people.
Yeah, that stuff is great.
It actually reminds me, I'll put a link in the show notes. There's this, there's a thing called the Technobabble generator, where you just push the button and it generates a line of complete techno jargon here. I'm going to pull it up real quick just because I got to entice people to click through to the link here.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So, that kind of thing you're talking about, that's the stuff that at first was kind of throwing me off, because that scene that you're describing, that happened prior to us knowing about the narrative, right?
Right.
So that now, you know, a second read, it totally makes sense. The first time through, all these little mysteries weren't adding up in my head because I just didn't see them going to this idea that they're on a TV show. That because you had said that people might know this is a meta book, I had no idea when I picked it up.
Yeah, so hopefully I didn't spoil it too badly for anybody.
No, it's fine.
Okay, so the Star Trek Random Technobabble Generator has spit out for me Phased System Interface. If I click it again, it's Auxiliary Frequency Coupling.
So. That was kind of fun. Do you mind if we talk a little bit about the time travel stuff?
Yeah, go for it.
This would be probably, I really like this book. Obviously, I picked it to discuss with you. It was one of my favorite reads of last year. But there was one problem I have with it is I'm a little bit picky on time travel stories. So I mentioned things earlier that I was really into growing up, but I didn't mention Back to the Future. Back to the Future was really influential on me when it comes to, I think, the different genres of sci-fi that I like. So in Back to the Future, you got both time travel and multiple parallel universes. And so now, even today, all these years later, those are two areas I really like. So I really like time travel that's done well. I do think there's a little bit of a logic problem in the fact that they can travel back in time to meet the writers of the TV show, because I think, and again, I should not overanalyze this book. That's just supposed to be for fun. But if I have to pick out, if I have to pick one thing that didn't quite work for me, you know, the writers wouldn't be in the same universe that these characters are in. So even if they did travel back in time, they shouldn't be able to go meet the actors that play them. But all those scenes ended up being fun. So if I can just set that aside, I can enjoy the story they're telling. But logically, I had a little bit of a hang up with that. I actually had the same problem with, I just recently, just in the last week or two, watched the movie Frequency. It was my second viewing. I saw Frequency when it first came out back in, what was that, 2000 maybe? I saw it at the theater. Have you seen this movie Frequency with Jim Caviezel?
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So really liked it. I've always, even though this was only my second viewing, over the years I've had this in my head as a movie that was kind of a 5-star view and really enjoyed it. But, you know, rewatching it here just in the last week or so, there are some weird time travel inconsistencies where, you know, they try to act like some, you know, changing something big in the past doesn't alter things significantly in the present day. And so I feel like there's some time travel inconsistencies here. What did you feel about that when it came to them traveling to the past and then meeting the writers of the show?
Yeah, I guess I didn't have too much of a problem with it. And to me, it never stood out that it was actually traveling to their own personal past, but somehow traveling through a dimensional barrier or something to essentially a parallel universe where the timeline, the time didn't completely overlap, right? It was 400 years in the past or something. And the television show was currently in production.
Okay, so that's something I can get on board with. If you're talking, yeah, they travel to a different universe, that I'm totally fine with that. Traveling to their past and meeting the actors, that wouldn't really work for me.
Yeah, I mean, it might be like you say, the kind of thing you shouldn't dig into too deeply, because you can, therein lies madness.
Yes.
My biggest problem with the time travel was they were a little too easy with it, right? Where they arrive on Earth hundreds of years earlier, and they know what a valet ticket is. Mm-hmm. They were way too familiar, it seemed to me, with 20th or 21st century Earth stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Although, kind of to the book's credit as well, Scalzi didn't really have them have any technology that was super, super advanced, apart from, of course, space travel and, you know, the ability to time travel and that kind of thing. But like they all had phones, right? They didn't have some kind of advanced communicator. They had phones. They had smartphones. And lots of times in science fiction, you end up with guesses about technology that go really, really badly. And so I like the fact that he didn't try to extrapolate too far. He's just like, you know what? Phones are really, really handy. Maybe we still have them in the future.
Yeah. So. You know what I liked when it comes to, you know, still talking about the time travel thing, but sort of an interesting rule that he pointed out when it comes to time travel in TV. I probably have picked up on this, but subconsciously, he talked about how if a character, because just as to catch the listeners up, when they were trying to figure out what year to travel to, they had to know, well, what year is the show being written in? And so one of the characters helped them dissect the rules of television. So if a character goes to the past and then meets a historical figure, then the actual writers of the show could be from any year because you're going to go meet somebody specific. But if they just go to some random year and they don't meet any historical figures, then typically the show writers are bringing the characters back to the present day of the show writers.
Right.
See what I'm saying? Yeah. So
doesn't require as much set dressing to do present day.
Yeah. And so that's something that you and I probably have seen countless times in television and movies, but I don't think I've ever laid it out exactly like that in my own head, but it makes sense.
Yeah. Like Star Trek IV, right? They come back to, you know, 1986 Earth.
Right. Exactly.
Is pretty easy to do it. It lets them do the fish out of water thing, but it keeps them from having to do any amazing technology or like having to have them go back to the 30s or something. You know, they'd have to have backlots and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So they're able to extrapolate from that based on other events that they'd experienced, which they realized were actually part of a TV show. They were able to travel and go to the year that the show was being written, which that part did work for me. If I can, you know, with the time travel stuff aside.
Yeah. So one other kind of minor gripe that I have, you know, I'm not offended by bad language or anything like that too much. When it gets to be excessive, then I'm kind of like, well, there's a little lack of creativity here, having everybody drop the F-bomb all the time. But in this one, the one thing that I could do without is all the talks about trading sexual favors.
Yeah.
I'm like, really? I guess I don't really have a problem with it, but it's one of those things that I could have done without.
Yeah, it did kind of feel like it got a little overboard.
Yeah.
You know, we kind of alluded to it earlier, but some people have said that the three codas at the end of this book actually make it a worse reading experience. I think you and I seem to like it. So, you know, where do you kind of land at? What did you think of the three sections that kind of make up an epilogue?
Yeah, and I think even if you just look at Coda 1, for me, the one about the writer wrestling with how to write good stories without killing people and kind of finally coming to the realization, it's not that he can't kill off characters. It's just that it has to mean something, right? You can't frivolously do it to create false drama. And that one was really profound to me just because of the whole kind of the core question in this book is about the creator's duty to his creation. And this is where you and I probably get into some theological ideas about that, right? But even from kind of an artistic standpoint, right, is the art itself what's valuable, or does the author have to do right by his characters? Is it possible for him to do wrong by his characters? And you look at something like Stranger Than Fiction, which I think you said you watched recently, right?
Yeah. So in this first coda that you're mentioning, the writer of that coda is one of the writers for the TV show. And he, at this point, is caught up on the fact that he's writing a world that is coming true and people are experiencing the things he does to them. So he lists out a few different metafiction well-known books or movies or TV shows, that kind of thing. So yeah, Stranger Than Fiction was on that list. And we can talk about some of the other ones. I ended up reading or watching a few of the things that he mentioned.
Yeah.
So yeah, Stranger Than Fiction, great example.
But so in that movie, right, the main character finds out that who's the main character? Is it Will Ferrell?
In some ways, Will Ferrell was actually the main character, and he's the character in someone else's book.
Right.
But he's also living in the same world as her.
Right. Yeah. The writer finds out that her main character is actually a living person. And from an art perspective, like the way that her character dies sacrificially was a better story, right? Objectively, well, not objectively, and nothing's objective in art, right? But the Dustin Hoffman character is like, this is a wonderful story. And then, but she decides that she has to do right by her character and have him survive at the expense of the art. And that's kind of what that whole Coda One is about to me in Red Shirts, where he has to figure out how to make it okay that he's causing death here, but it's all right because it's in the service of a good story.
Yeah, I like those elements that are kind of under the surface.
Yeah, and I also really like the reason this one's my favorite Coda as well is because it's done kind of in a blog format.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that fascinating. I'm not sure how well that'll age. You know, blogging has probably hit its peak. I don't know.
Yeah.
So, but I really do like that. Just the idea that you can put people in danger. You can kill off characters. It's just, you can't do it for cheap drama.
So another one of the books mentioned or book series, mentioned in that Coda, is a book series by the author Jasper Ford. And In this series, characters can travel in and out of books. So it's not exactly the same thing, although they do influence. They're able to then change what happens in the story that we're, so for example, the first book that they, or the first book in the series is called The Eyre Affair, based on Jane Eyre. And so the main character goes into Jane Eyre and then changes plot elements. And then the finished product after that book ends is what you and I have in our real world.
Oh, wow.
So there was a different version of Jane Eyre that existed before it was changed in this book. And then there's a, you know, Last Action Hero was mentioned, which I haven't seen for years, but I actually saw in the movie theater years ago with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I never did see that one.
Are you familiar with it, though, where Arnold Schwarzenegger is an action hero who comes into our real world?
Right. Where he can't say the F word because it's PG-13.
Yeah. And then one other one that is mentioned in this Coda is a book series by Denise Hogan. But as I Googled this name, this person doesn't actually exist because in Coda 1, Denise Hogan interacts with our writer.
Right.
So she is not a real author.
Nice. Well, do you want to talk about the other Codas? Do you have anything else that you want to talk about the main narrative?
There might be some things that pop back up. I'm interested in talking about the Codas. The first one, I agree with you. I think that was my favorite as well. More of the meta stuff that I like talking about. The second one... And we should also say that they're in first person, second person, and third person as they're written.
Right.
Second one was okay for me, I think. I mean, I thought I like the idea that it's dealing with how your memories make you who you are. That's been a subject that's been interesting to me lately. Sure. That I'll go ahead.
Yeah. Well, and just the kind of concept there that somebody shouldn't just go through life, right? Shouldn't just coast through life, should actually aspire to something. Where this is the director's son or the writer's son, who had just been kind of shiftlessly going through life, going from one, you know, major to another and never settling on anything. And the fact that he had this second chance at life because he had been in it like a terrible motorcycle wreck or something, and had been resurrected through use of the narrative, which I thought was terrific.
Yeah.
And so finding out that in fact he had a second chance at life, he resolves to do something with his life, and I don't know, it's inspiring.
Yeah, definitely. So, let's talk about the third one. But then I'm interested to see kind of which ones worked for you the most, or did all of them work for you? But why don't you talk about the third one as well?
Yeah. So the third one is that's the one with Jenkins' wife, right?
Right.
Where the actress who played Jenkins' wife, where I think his name is Dahl, right? Andrew Dahl.
Mm-hmm.
He had given her something from Jenkins.
So yeah, some pictures and some letters.
Yeah. I found that one sweet, but not terribly profound.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see what you're saying. I think in my initial viewing, reading, loved the first one. Second one kind of dragged for me a little bit, but then the third one brought it back around for me because I like that sweet aspect. I like that, yeah, in a sense, there was some closure for characters that they didn't experience in the main narrative that we had just read. I thought it was, I do think of the three, it's probably the best way to end the book. But
yeah,
I agree. So I guess if I had to stack them, probably the first one was my favorite, third one was my second, and then second one was my third favorite. But they all, I just really like the idea that this author tried to do something different by adding the Codas to the end.
Yeah.
And they're sort of, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was going to say, well, you know, with the end of the third Coda, that's the last thing you read then. And there's a sort of hope for future for some of the characters that appear in there when it comes to future relational things or like I said before, closure. So I thought,
what it does is it kind of, it dovetails nicely with the fact that the, you know, the people on the Intrepid are going to be okay. And the people here back on Earth are also going to be okay. And I like that. I just wanted to kind of talk about, some other kind of thematic things. You had mentioned that there's some interesting theological concepts here.
Yeah, absolutely. That, I mean, for you and me, Christians, I mean, this stuff, pops out a lot when it comes to that free will aspect. And I mean, in Christianity, there is sort of a debate on how much of our lives is our own choosing and how much is this is just what's going to happen no matter what. So free will versus predestination. And so when we have those aspects of our main characters doing things that they couldn't control, that's kind of scary to me because, that's not the version of a God that you would necessarily want, somebody who's just making you do whatever they want.
Well, and that kind of question is by no means limited to Christianity either.
Exactly.
Other faiths have it. And even the scientific question of is there free will or is everything not preordained, but how do you put it in scientific terms?
Well, in sci-fi terms, when you have time travel stories, there's sometimes where you cannot change an event. Even if you travel to the past, the event is set and it's just, it's supposed to be like that for some reason. And so whether you say fate or a higher power or just time itself doesn't want to be changed, some things are just meant to be, it feels like.
Right. Well, and before the discovery of, kind of quantum weirdness, there was a sense that the clockwork universe kind of where here we have the starting conditions and everything moves forward. And so we should be able to look at the way things happen and predict everything. Right. And so everything has to be more or less predestined, right? Where there's no free will. You are just acting out your part in your one little cog in the machine and you go through your things and you think that you have free will, but you don't. From my perspective, like if I think I've got free will, if to me, my decisions seem to be my own, I'm not sure what the difference is. Because I feel like my decisions are free.
Mm-hmm.
The other idea, though, in this, to me, is the there's the kind of the deist idea of the existence of God, but he's the blind watchmaker, right? Where he starts everything up, hits go, and then moves on, right? And never intervenes, never cares. And that to me is it's not an appealing idea at all. But then even the exact opposite of that is the Calvinist conception where God controls every little thing. Everything that happens is the will of God. I think Islam is that way as well. That's not at all appealing to me. And so I kind of go in the middle.
Yeah, I feel like, again, this is more from a Christian perspective, but when you look at biblical passages, there's aspects that support free will and aspects that support predestination. And this debate has been going on for hundreds of years and it's not been solved. So for me, I'm with you, Seth, that it has to be something in between. There has to be some aspect of we have free will, but also some aspect of God is over everything. So I don't know exactly how that shakes out, but I feel comfortable in the mystery of being in between.
Yeah. But, you know, I like science fiction that brings up those kind of questions.
So. Yeah, me too. Yeah, definitely. I also liked when it comes to some other themes, I do feel like there was sort of I don't know what the author's personal thoughts are on this subject, but it felt like there was sort of an underlying criticism of bad writing happening in here where I get the sense he has a love for old Star Trek, but at the same time, maybe this is a criticism of modern storytelling then, because it felt like something about, like you were saying earlier, treat your characters with respect. Don't just do crazy things for the sake of being crazy. You know, I don't watch the show Walking Dead, but you hear a lot about people dying left and right there. I wonder if it's a show like that where he feels like, yeah, lots of people love it and it's got a huge following, but it's not actually very good writing.
Right. I do still watch The Walking Dead, and I would say it's the opposite problem where there aren't enough stakes, right? Not enough. It's not realistic that most of this group is still alive. There was a pretty high body count for the first couple seasons, but since then it's been almost status quo until the end of the last season.
Okay. I mean, I just brought that up as a random example. I don't even watch that show necessarily, but I just, in general, I think that could be something that he could be commenting on, but I'm not 100% sure on that.
Yeah. Well, and I've heard you and Ben talk about Game of Thrones, where so many characters are killed off, but that is kind of, from what I understand, Ben did a YouTube thing about Game of Thrones, and it kind of about the book, mm-hmm. And how it kind of comments on fantasy. And I realized that that's the reason that I didn't enjoy the book as much as I probably could have, is that I'm not much of a fantasy fan. And so to see tropes of fantasy subverted, I don't know the tropes well enough to really get the impact of that. But the idea that you're going to have this noble hero, you know, your Aragorn figure in Ned Stark, right? And he's going to be the guy who's going to ultimately win the day and become king, right? No, I'm sorry. He's going to die. He's played by Sean Bean. Of course he's going to die.
Yeah.
I don't know. And you've read more of those books than I have. Do you feel like the killing off of characters is done for cheap thrills, or is it done in the service of something?
That's a great question. For that series specifically, I guess I'd say for the overall plot that the author is driving, but I don't know for a fact, but I'm interested in what you said about subverting old formulas, because I'm not very familiar with the fantasy genre in general, but I like to learn about it from people like my co-host Ben, where he'll kind of point out, well, here's what's actually happening. So I appreciate and respect that kind of thing, even though I don't think I can fully grasp every aspect of it, since I also didn't have that background. But so to your original question, I guess I'd say I feel like it's story driven, but who knows for sure. I guess I don't feel like it's necessarily bad writing, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he's not saying that. It came up so many times in this book that, oh, we're on a badly written TV show, that I was wondering, is there something here below the surface that he's trying to get at?
Yeah. Well, on his actual blog, he did specify, by the way, I'm not talking about Stargate Universe, which he was currently involved with.
Okay.
So.
Interesting.
But I mean, there's no denying that when you look at kind of campy science fiction from the 70s and 60s, you know, there was a lot of bad writing. And when I look back at the Star Trek, the original series, yeah, there were lots of times where unimportant characters were killed off and seemingly introduced just to be killed off. And part of that, I think, is that the episodes were actually longer. Because if you look at, like, if you're watching on Netflix, watching the original series versus Next Generation, it's like 50 minutes long for the original episodes, original series episodes, and then 42 minutes for TNG.
Hey, get
so
this.
Had a little more time to fill.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, commercials weren't as prominent. Get this. I actually, just for the show, I did a tiny bit of research on this whole red shirt phenomenon.
Oh, okay.
Here's the exact stats. Of the 59 crew members killed in the original series, 43, which is 73%, were wearing red shirts.
Right.
73%, everybody.
Mm-hmm. I've seen a couple different analyses that say, no. If you look at it on raw numbers, sure, lots of red shirts. But if you look at it on percentage of that color shirts, then it's much more likely that yellow shirts die in a much higher percentage.
Oh, that's interesting too.
To me, I don't know. It kind of misses the point. I mean, I know it's called red shirts, right? And so the point would be, these are the expendable crewmen who's wearing a red shirt. But really, it's just talking about the expendable character, right? Crewman Guy from Galaxy Quest, right? What's my last name?
Yeah, exactly.
or even like, you know, I really appreciate that kind of thing. Like in the J.J. Abrams 2009 Star Trek, where they do the sky jump down to the platform or whatever, and the guy wearing the red shirt goes into the beam.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I love that. So
yeah, I like the joke of it. I like the trope.
Have you ever played Flux?
No, I haven't.
So there's a variation of it called Star Flux, where all of the bits and bobs in it are from things like Doctor Who and Star Trek and Star Wars. And there's a whole series of cards that you want to try and collect: the captain, the doctor, the engineer, and there's one called the expendable crewman. And in the game, you can steal cards from other people. But if you have the expendable crewman, if someone tries to steal one of your cards, they have to take the expendable crewman.
Okay.
First, which I think is terrific.
So, oh, that is kind of funny.
Yeah. So, anything else you want to talk about, Matt?
Yeah. You know, when it comes to sort of, final thoughts on this type of thing, I was thinking through the end of the actual narrative of the book, mm-hmm. where you had Andy talking to his friend, whose name I believe was Jimmy. Do you remember that character?
Hester?
No, not him. His friend, the rich guy.
Wasn't it Hester? I thought Hester was the rich guy. This is one of the actual problems of the book, is that a lot of the characters have similar names.
Here we go. I got it. Yeah, we got, is Jimmy Hansen. And then Hester is, Hester was the one that was also the son, right?
Yes.
Let's just say that. So Andy's talking to Jimmy. They've been friends the whole time. And, you know, in your second read of the book, you do kind of notice Jimmy had a small part to play, but when you look at all the ups and downs of the plot, if we are talking about there's an outside force running a narrative, it didn't really seem like he had a major part of this overall story. Like, what did he really do in the plot? And so in the last pages of the book or of the narrative, they talk about that. And then it's as if the creator is using the Jimmy character to talk to Andy. And I don't know what feeling the author was going for, maybe hopeful. But what the feeling I actually got was ominous. It just kind of felt like this outside force. They went through this whole adventure, but this outside force is still really there controlling everything. So even though they've worked out a deal with the writers and things are probably going to be okay, and I think we do get a sense of what's going to happen in the future based on the final pages, they're still inside a fictional world. And, you know, it's real to them. But I think I was left, like I said, with a more ominous feeling from that. Do you remember that scene?
Yeah, and I kind of agree. It's not creepy, but
creepy.
It's melancholy.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So, in the end, then, you know, when he has a joke chapter about, you know, 6 months later, the ship gets blown up, right, and they all die. And if that had been the true ending of the book, I would have, I probably would have said, yeah, that makes sense. For what I just read, that kind of makes sense. But then that chapter ends and you turn to the next page and he said, no, I'm just kidding. They all lived happily ever after, or however he worded it. Yeah.
He dropped an F-bomb.
Yeah. sort of a, it was just kind of a weird way to end the narrative. It was as if he was kind of like, well, I guess we're done.
Yeah. And it's kind of an editorial comment almost at the very end, where he hadn't really done that for the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Because he actually says, no, I'm just messing with you or effing with you.
Yes. Yes. It's as if the creator or the writer is a character now.
Right.
He spoke through Jimmy and then he talks to us through through these last words.
Yeah. Yeah. The funny thing is, I feel like in print that effect doesn't work super, super well, because the end of the one chapter and the I'm just kidding is on the facing page.
Mm-hmm.
Where in the ebook, the way I read it, you actually have to swipe to the next page before he drops that bomb on you, right?
And
you swipe to the next page and says, no, I'm just kidding. I feel like there's more impact there, or maybe in the audiobook, than in the print book.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So no, I love talking about it with you. I love this book, even with its I have a few quibbles, but overall, great read for me.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, this is not great literature.
Right.
It's not Hyperion. It's not Dune, right? You could even kind of go, oh, why did this one win the Hugo this year? But I don't know. It's terrific fun for the main kind of narrative. And then it's just kind of surprisingly profound in the codas to me. And so that whole metafiction thing, and then just the kind of philosophic discussions of what is the author's duty here to his characters, I think is definitely worth reading. And worth thinking about, right? For any kind of creator, for anything you do in life, what is your duty to this creation that you have?
Right.
Yeah, it's good to think about.
Oh, you're totally right. When you look at the other books on the list, even just the ones I read, Dune, Ender's Game, Hyperion, Lord of Light, those are, you know, well-written classics. So Redshirts,
those are more literary books.
Yeah, I'll be honest, even though I liked it, Redshirts doesn't seem to fit, but there is something happening there for people that are wondering, how did this make the list? There's more happening than you would expect. And, you know, from the philosophical stuff to even just the unique structure of the book, there's a reason it won. It's not just because it was fun. There's deeper things happening.
Yeah, it's good stuff. I guess we've covered final thoughts, haven't we?
Yeah, I think that was kind of where I landed with it.
Yeah, cool. All right, well, where can people find you, Matt?
All right, yeah, you can find me at thescifichristian.com. We do a weekly podcast called The Sci-Fi Christian. It's myself and Ben DeBono. And just have a great time talking through, like I said earlier, anything from theology to philosophy to pop culture or whatever else we just want to talk about that week.
Cool. And then do you still do a Comic Book Time Machine?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, this is a podcast I do a little bit more sporadically. It's called The Comic Book Time Machine. More of just kind of a pet project that I do with a couple other friends of mine. And there is no release schedule that I could give you that would we stick with very strictly. Just here and there. But Seth, you've been on there before. We talked about some DC comics. What was it? That was just last year.
Yeah, it was DC Rebirth.
So to be honest, you know, whereas I do weekly releases for the Sci-Fi Christian, I probably do, this is maybe an underestimate, but 3 to 5 episodes a year with that one.
Right.
so.
Right. Well, I think that one's unique too, where you have your other co-hosts who will release episodes here and there. So it's not like it's everybody on every episode.
Exactly. Yeah. We have 3 hosts and we take turns doing solo episodes, and here and there we do a big group episode, but pretty rarely. Yeah. So yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Yeah. Not something I do as much, but still out there in the world if you like comic books as well.
Cool. All right. Well, I think that's about going to wrap it up there, Matt. So I really want to thank you for doing this, taking time out of your day.
No, appreciate it. Like I said, I love it. I love this conversation. I always appreciate the opportunity for you and me to connect. And I think this is, you know, I was on Take Me to Your Reader. I was you were with me on Comic Book Time Machine. Now we've done this. So we got to get you on Sci-Fi Christian and we'll complete the series.
But maybe I can come on there and we can do the Once and Future King discussion.
Yes, I love that. No, but thank you for inviting me on. I really had a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe we can do something down the line.
Yeah, definitely. We'll connect with Ben. This is sort of on our radar for next year or so. So maybe we'll push it up on the schedule and we'll get you on there.
Cool. Sounds good, Matt. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Thanks. All right, talk to you later. Bye.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Matt, and I will make sure to put links to all of his stuff in the show notes. So make sure to check out Sci-Fi Christian, Comic Book Time Machine. And of course, if you'd like to reach out to us, you can do that, feedback@hugospodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter @hugospodcast. Give us a like on Facebook, facebook.com/hugospodcast. And if you would share and retweet and all that kind of good stuff, I'd really appreciate that. And if you'd like to give us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, however you listen to us, that would be wonderful as well. I'm really still enjoying doing this podcast, 10 episodes in, and I've got a bunch more great guests lined up for future episodes. It's a little bit of a bummer that I can only do one a month, but the fact is that's about all I can manage. So I'm going to keep plugging away at them. So look for new episodes in the future. And that'll wrap it up. So I'll talk to you next time. Bye.